Canada, the Great White North, a utopia of manners, healthcare, and big-hearted people saying hey. Sadly, that place doesn't exist. I'm Jordan, and on my show Nighttime, I uncover a version of Canada that is far darker than the one used in advertising to sell coffee, beer, and cars. The Canada I discuss on Nighttime is a twisted maze of crime, missing persons cases, unexplained events, and stories that prove Canada is not what they want you to think. If you want to join me, subscribe to the Nighttime Podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or anywhere else.
Skip ahead about 40 seconds if the resources I've been giving bother you. There is a crisis text line set up for those suffering from anxiety or depression. Text 741-741 for help. If you're experiencing suicidal thoughts, please call the National Suicide Hotline at 1-800-273-TALK or 8255. If you're suffering from domestic violence, please call 1-800-799-SAFE or 7233 or dial 911. The Trevor Project has a hotline for young LGBTQ people who are struggling. Call 1-866-488-7386. Remember, you are not alone. I'll have international resources as well as these U.S. numbers in today's show notes. Southern Fried True Crime covers cases that are not suitable for young listeners, and there may also be some explicit language used. Today's episode involves violence against children, so listener discretion is strongly advised. In 1967, Auburn, Alabama, was devastated by a shocking and brutal attack on a widow and her four daughters. It was the kind of crime that outraged citizens and reverberated for generations. And it was complicated because this was at a time that we didn't fully understand the danger of stalking. The first time stalking was criminalized was in California in 1990, 23 years after the attack on the Sinclairs. In truth, Edward Sebold had terrorized the Sinclair family for more than a year before his horrific rampage. The mother, Juanita Sinclair, was not naive. She tried to protect her family. She did call the police. Neighbors urged her to buy a gun. But no one could have imagined the horror that Eddie Sebold would bring to the Sinclair home. It's another case of an obsession turning into murderous hatred. And like many of these kinds of cases, Sebold's sanity was called into question. Was he mentally ill? Or was he a spoiled brat, as prosecutors had called him? Welcome to episode 102, The Sinclair Murders. When you think of Auburn, Alabama, you think of Auburn University. It is intrinsically a college town. And in 1967, it certainly already was one. First chartered in 1856, the college went through four name changes, finally settling on Auburn University in 1960. And football lovers know that the Auburn University team is a member of the SEC, or Southeastern Conference. In 1892, the Tigers played their first game against the University of Georgia Bulldogs, beginning the oldest college rivalry in the Deep South. Today, the population in Auburn is a bit over 66,000 people, but in 1967, it was around 17 or 18,000, a much smaller city, but growing exponentially. Originally Native American Creek territory, Auburn is located in western Lee County and sits on the fall line juncture of the Piedmont Plateau and Coastal Plain. The city includes the southernmost exposure of rocks in the Appalachian Orogeny. The last foothill of the Appalachian Mountains is in the Chewakala State Park in southern Auburn. And in the west and southwestern parts of the city, there are rolling plains and savannas, a gorgeous, widely spaced canopy of trees. It is a beautiful city, and according to local legend, a young woman chose the town name from the first line of Oliver Goldsmith's poem, The Deserted Village. It reads, "Sweet Auburn, the loveliest village of the plain." In the 1960s, when the Sinclair family moved there, it was in the middle of one of its biggest growth spurts. Juanita Sinclair bought a modest split-level home on Gardner Drive. Born in December of 1921, Juanita had lost her husband, Lieutenant Colonel Hugh Sinclair, in 1961 to a sudden heart attack. He was only 41 years old, and the family was living on a base in Frankfurt, Germany at the time. Juanita's youngest daughter, Mary Lynn, who went by Lynn, was only 3 years old. She was born in New Jersey in May of 1958. The other three Sinclair sisters were all born in Alabama. Selma, Alabama, had been what they considered their hometown, and when the 41-year-old husband and father died, he was buried in the new Live Oak Cemetery in Selma. After moving to Auburn, Juanita supported her four daughters by teaching high school math and also working in the computer section of Auburn University. In 1967, her daughter Kathy, the oldest, was 20 years old. She had been born in July of 1947 and would have been around 14 years old when she lost her father. The next in line was Sarah Elizabeth, known as Libba. Born in December of 1948, she was less than 2 years younger than Kathy. Faye Sinclair was born in April of 1950, almost 2 years younger than Libba. And then Lynn was born 8 years later. All the girls had dark raven hair, and Kathy had blossomed into a beautiful young woman. Kathy had been a high-achieving student. All the girls were, actually. And she received a full scholarship to Wellesley College in Massachusetts. She had started classes there in the fall of 1965. On that terrible night in September of 1967, 20-year-old Kathy was getting ready to go back to Wellesley, sewing and packing her suitcases. She was up late sewing in the den area, and her suitcases were laid out on her mother's bed. 17-year-old Faye and 18-year-old Libba were sharing a bed because Faye had given hers up to her little sister so she could have a sleepover. 9-year-old Lynn and her neighbor and friend, 8-year-old Mary Durant, nicknamed Maymay, were sleeping in Faye's bed. Juanita was in the living room, lying on the couch peacefully, until Edward Siebold broke down her door. I'm going to pause now for a short commercial break. Edward Albert Siebold was a privileged young man. He was born in 1946 to Herman and Clara, and he had an older brother named Robert. His father, Dr. Herman Siebold, was a professor at Auburn University and then a research associate at Tulane University. The prosperous family owned homes on Long Island and in Louisiana, in addition to a place in Auburn. According to witness testimony at trial, Eddie suffered from swollen lymph nodes as an infant. From 13 to 16 years old, Eddie suffered from nightmares that caused him to wake up screaming. And Eddie was a problem kid for many years. His father was a strict disciplinarian, and Eddie disliked being told what to do, especially when to get out of bed. He bragged to friends that once, when his father tried to wake him up early for church, he threw him across the room. However, his behavior improved when he became involved with the Boy Scouts. Eddie reached the rank of Eagle Scout and attended national jamborees. A high school friend described Eddie as extremely smart. Many people described him as smart, and he seemed to be well-liked around that time. When it was time for college, Eddie qualified for a National Merit Scholarship and 5 honorary societies. When he started Auburn University in 1964, his father was still a professor there. According to his family, his attitude had completely changed. He made mostly A's with a few B's. First studying pre-law, then pre-med. He had trouble choosing a major. He also tried chemistry and then math. He was chosen as one of 8 scholars to represent Auburn in the College Bowl on a national television quiz show. But he dropped out of the College Bowl competition, complaining that someone on his team didn't like him. He also complained that schoolmates called him homosexual just because he liked poetry. Whether or not this is true is debatable. That's his reasoning. But it sounds like he was slipping backwards from the progress he made, again becoming argumentative, defensive, and angry. It was in an Auburn classroom in June of 1966 that he met Kathy Sinclair. She was auditing an English class in an Auburn summer session. Kathy and Eddie dated for a short while in the summer of 1966, but she would later say, quote, "But we were never more than good friends. I certainly didn't regard him as the only boy in my life. I dated several boys that summer." But she stayed friendly with Eddie when she returned to Wellesley that fall of 1966, exchanging letters and occasional phone calls. It was when Kathy went back to Massachusetts that Eddie became jealous and then obsessed. His school friends said he talked about her incessantly, and he had lost interest in school, dropping out and joining the Army Reserves just 6 months before he was supposed to graduate from Auburn. He supposedly did make up the last 2 credits through correspondence courses to get his degree. But his focus now wasn't just on Kathy. It was on her mother, Juanita. In November of 1966, he called Kathy at school and told her he was in love with her mother. Horrified, Kathy broke off contact. Eddie's brother Robert, a chemical engineer, was back home in Auburn at this time for grad school. He said that Eddie talked to him almost every day about 44-year-old Juanita Sinclair. He insisted he loved Juanita and that he knew she loved him too. He claimed that when he first let his feelings be known to her, Juanita returned his affection, briefly, before rejecting him. Juanita Sinclair vehemently denied this, saying it was all in Eddie's head. But she did say he told her, quote, "I get my way in everything." By Christmas of 1966, his father was working at Tulane, and he and Clara moved to their New Orleans home. I believe they sold their home in Auburn because of a later incident, so I'm assuming Robert and Eddie Siebold shared an apartment. The Siebold family got together for Christmas in New Orleans. They later said all Eddie could talk about was his hatred for Kathy Sinclair. It's never stated explicitly if this was because he was jealous or if he thought she stood between him and her mother. Whatever was going on in his mind, he was full of anger and rage, and his family was relieved when he enrolled in Binghamton University in New York that 1967 spring semester after Christmas. But college friends in New York heard much of the same about his obsession. One college peer, Mary, said Edward told her that he loved Juanita and that, quote, "he knew she loved him, but that she didn't know it yet." Edward told Mary that he wanted to marry Juanita and then have children of their own. She said he also ominously told her he would get back at Juanita for not returning his love. According to the Alabama Journal, another college peer, John, said that Eddie, quote, "showed him several slips of paper measuring about 6 inches by 1 inch, containing a comparison of the differences in ages between himself and Juanita on one hand, and between Frank Sinatra and his wife Mia Farrow on the other." Eddie told John that he'd put about 250 of those slips of paper on windshields all over Auburn. Eddie also wrote a poem about his imaginary affair with Juanita. It took 1.5 hours to recite it all from memory, and he often annoyed his friends with this odd obsession. And Eddie's parents were alarmed when in April of 1967, Eddie left school and then called them from Auburn. When Kathy came home for spring vacation in 1967, she saw Eddie a few times, and he started threatening her. Kathy said, quote, "Once, when I was in the backyard, he hit me in the face hard enough to knock my glasses off. He twisted my arm." She said he told her, quote, "all I want to do is hurt you, and I know that hurting any member of your family is hurting you." The next day, Eddie stood outside the Sinclair house and wouldn't leave. Juanita had to call the police. In May, Juanita was able to get what was called a peace warrant against Eddie Siebold. That's like a restraining order. Eddie called his mother Clara and was furious. She rushed to Auburn to be with him and to try to calm him down. They had dinner with friends, and afterwards, she said Eddie started screaming at her that she had to help him. He wanted his mother to go and plead with Juanita Sinclair, down on her knees, he said, so that he would be allowed to go and visit Kathy at the Sinclair home. This is what Clara said were his exact words, but it would now seem he was either focused back on Kathy or he had not told his mother about his feelings for Juanita. It's not really clear what she knew when. But when she refused to go talk to Juanita, he actually threw a nut at her face, hitting her in the eye, still screaming at her. She said she would no longer discuss the topic and was going to walk back to her motel. It's because she said specifically that she stayed in a motel to come see her son that I believe they had sold their Auburn home. Regardless, she walked out of the restaurant and Eddie followed her. He got into his car and tried to run his own mother down. Clara Siebold was able to jump behind a tree, and Eddie slammed on his brakes right before hitting the tree. After this disturbing incident, Clara tried to have him committed. She spoke to 6 or 7 people, including a doctor, a dean of men, a lawyer, a psychiatrist, and the head of a mental clinic, but no one would help her. The psychiatrist even told Clara that she was not good for Eddie and that she should go home. The psychiatrist said Eddie was, quote, neither homicidal nor suicidal. He was neurotic and suffered emotional disturbances, but he wasn't insane. In August of 1967, Eddie drove onto the Sinclair lawn and broke several windows in their house. He was arrested and later said his father bailed him out and told Eddie he would only get him out of jail if he agreed to leave Auburn. By the time of the murders the following month, Eddie had been stalking the family for over a year. Not just outright threats, but in sinister, creepy ways. He broke into their house and left notes, and even followed them when they went on vacation. In a 2012 Opelika Auburn News article, Zach Sprayberry Jr., a neighbor, recalled that his dad, Zach Sr., had told Juanita she needed to reinforce the locks on all of her doors. And he said, quote, he tried to give her a gun, but she didn't want a gun in her house. It was 17-year-old Zach Sprayberry Jr. who answered an urgent knock on his door around midnight on September 7th, 1967. He said he opened the door to Dr. Ben Thomas, who lived down the street from him on Gardner Drive. He lived 3 doors down from the Sinclairs. He told the newspaper, quote, he came to get Daddy, and he had a pistol in his hand. He said, get Zach now. That Siebold boy just shot Juanita. I'm going to pause now to hear a word from today's sponsors. We have smartphones, smart cars, and smart homes. It's an amazing time in technology. But what about a smart mattress? Mattresses have been more or less the same since the invention of sleep. We deserve better. And finally, the mattress has evolved thanks to Purple. The secret to Purple is the amazing Purple Grid. It's a patented comfort technology that instantly adapts to your body's shape and sleep style. Purple is for everybody, no matter how you sleep. I tend to be a side sleeper, which isn't always great for my back. But with Purple's design that adapts to my body, it curves with my spine instead of pushing against it like a traditional mattress. It is designed with over 2,800 open air channels and naturally temperature-neutral gel. As someone who tends to get too hot when I sleep, this is a major factor for me when I'm buying a mattress. With Purple, you'll never sleep too hot or too cold. The Purple mattress is soft where you want it, but firm where you need it, and it's comfortably cool all over. This mattress truly does it all. And you can count on resting easy every night, year after year, because the ultra-durable Purple Grid won't sink or lose shape. Purple is so confident in what they do that every Purple mattress comes with free shipping and returns and a risk-free 100-night trial. Experience the next evolution of sleep. Go to purple.com/southernfried and use promo code southernfried. For a limited time, you'll get $150 off any Purple mattress order of $1,500 or more. That's purple.com/southernfried, promo code southernfried. For $150 off any mattress order of $1,500 or more. Terms apply. Getting in shape isn't always looking for that magic number on the scale. It's about practicing self-care so you can feel better about yourself, which is really personal. That's why Noom is so great. It's a program that adjusts to your lifestyle. Noom is not a diet. It's a habit-changing solution that helps you develop a new relationship with food through personalized courses. Noom teaches you the psychology behind the decisions you make and helps you keep track of everything from workouts to logging your meals. Noom has one of the largest and most accurate food databases available, so you can track your meal habits, visualize portion sizes, and check calories at a glance. Noom has given me the ability to make healthy choices more easily, taking the anxiety out of meal planning. And I love the ease of using the Noom app. It's just 10 minutes out of my day to help me keep track of what I eat, find new recipes, and connect with the Noom community. Aside from a personal goal specialist, there is a whole community of Noomers cheering you on, all in the palm of your hand. You don't have to change it all in one day. Small steps make big progress. Sign up for your trial today at Noom, Noom.com/Southern Fried. What do you have to lose? Visit Noom.com/Southern Fried to start your trial today. Again, that's Noom.com/Southern Fried. On the evening of September 6th, 1967, 9-year-old Lynn had asked if her friend May May, 8-year-old Mary Durant from next door, could come and spend the night. Juanita said yes, and the girls were going to sleep in the double bed in Faye's room. 17-year-old Faye decided to bunk with Libba, her 18-year-old sister. By 11:50 p.m., all four of those girls were sleeping in bedrooms on the third floor. Kathy was up late, eager to return to school and sewing and repairing clothing. She had her suitcases laid out on her mother's bed. The split-level home had a lower level, a sort of basement, that had windows to the backyard that they used as a den. That's where Kathy was sewing. Juanita Sinclair had fallen asleep on the living room couch. The living room was on the second floor, which was on the ground level, where the front door was located. Edward Siebold broke down the front door, and he was armed with a shotgun and a hatchet. Juanita jumped up, so when he shot at her, she was luckily only hit in the arm. She ran out the front door for help as he started going down to the lower level where the den was. Kathy had heard the shot and heard his familiar voice yell, "Where is Kathy?" And she quickly hid in a closet. Eddie walked down to the den and looked around. Then he looked into a small bedroom adjacent to the den, and there was a life-size doll on the bed. He fired at the doll, maybe thinking it was Lynn. He went back up to the ground level and then started heading upstairs to the bedrooms. Faye had heard the shots downstairs and Eddie yelling, so she had rolled quietly off the bed and then crawled under it, hiding. It's not clear if Libba heard the commotion and froze, or if she didn't awaken. But when Eddie burst into their room, she rose from the bed. Faye watched as Eddie hit Libba with a shotgun. She fell back onto the bed and tried to rise again. He kept beating her with a shotgun as he dragged her out into the hallway screaming, "Where's Kathy? Where's Mrs. Sinclair?" Faye heard Libba whimpering, "I don't know, I don't know." Then he went to what he thought was Faye's room. This is from his own testimony. And when he opened the door, he saw two little girls. He later said he thought it was two Lynns. Confused, he aimed the shotgun, and as the girls were huddled together, he killed them both with one shot. He said he then turned around and saw Libba standing in the doorway with her hand to her throat. He claimed that as he looked at the wall above Faye's bed, a hole opened up and a hurricane came out and blew him and Libba into the hallway. As they fell into the hallway, Edward brought a hatchet down on Libba's throat. In a sickening 2007 interview, he told the story with very gory details, and before he mentions the supposed hurricane vision, he said, quote, "This is the Stephen King stuff." What Faye remembers is that after she heard him and Libba arguing, she heard the other shot, and then Libba fell silent for a moment, and then Faye heard what she called a gurgling sound from her sister. Eddie later told the Montgomery Advisor, quote, "It didn't make any sense to kill Libba. She was a substitute target. If I couldn't locate Kathy, I'd take down Libba or Faye. I didn't know if Kathy would be there or not. It sounds as if he was looking to totally destroy the Sinclair family, regardless of whether Kathy was there or not. He had already told her he knew hurting any of her family members would hurt her. After he murdered Libba, he walked down to the second level and ran out the back door. When he had gone upstairs, Kathy had crawled out of a window in the den and found her bleeding mother on the carport. Then they hid in the storage room together. When it finally fell silent, Kathy and Juanita ran to Dr. Ben Thomas's house, three doors down. Faye stayed under the bed, trembling in the silence, until the phone rang. She was afraid to move at first, but when it rang again, she crawled out from under the bed and went down to the den and answered it. It was a neighbor calling, and she told him to get the doctor and call the police. Then in a daze, she walked through the house. She found Libba in the hallway and tried to find a pulse, but her sister, just a year older than her, was dead. She went into the room where the little girls, Lynn and Maymay, had been sleeping and was horrified to find them covered in blood. She checked for pulses on the girls too, but they were already gone. She then made her way to the living room on the ground level, and as she walked out, Dr. Thomas and a police officer met her. In a Times Tribune article from March 31, 1968, it was reported that the doctor and police officer came into the house and found Faye holding the shotgun, that she had picked it up in the living room where Eddie had dropped it. This isn't in the appeals documents, so I am unsure if this was from actual testimony or from a story the doctor told, because he is then quoted as saying, "I've been in war and I've seen combat, but nothing like this." And Eddie Sebold had escaped into the night. A huge manhunt began, and Auburn residents were terrified. Libba and Lynn were laid to rest in New Live Oak Cemetery in Selma, Alabama, near their father. Juanita Sinclair was unable to attend her daughter's funerals because she was still in the hospital. Armed guards were at the funerals to protect Kathy and Faye, the surviving daughters. The Sinclair home was also constantly guarded. Police were afraid that Eddie would come back to finish what he started. On September 8th, the FBI joined the investigation, and a federal fugitive warrant was issued. On September 9th, around 100 armed people, state troopers, police, and ROTC officers, searched for Eddie in a wooded area near the Auburn University campus. Authorities had received a tip that a man who looked like Edward Sebold was seen in the woods, but it wasn't Eddie. It would seem that Eddie Sebold had planned the attack and his escape carefully. He drove to New Orleans in his own car, and then rented a minibus and drove to Ocala, Florida, where he abandoned it in a lumberyard. Police issued nationwide bulletins on Sebold, so the case quickly gained national attention. A Miami woman saw Eddie's photo in a magazine. Then she saw him walking down the street and called and reported him to the police. On September 17th, the FBI tracked down where Eddie was working in Miami. He had answered a classified ad to be a companion to a disabled young man. Eddie got the job, and when the FBI raided the home, the parents of the disabled boy were shocked. They had thought he was a nice guy. Eddie was actually found sleeping in the same room as the boy. When they woke him, he screamed and resisted arrest. He was subdued and arrested, and then for the next 6 weeks, he fought extradition. Finally, in December, Eddie was extradited back to Alabama, where he was charged with 3 counts of murder and 1 count of assault with intent to murder. The prosecution planned separate trials for all the charges. Haley and I both could not find the reason why. Typically, a case of multiple murders that happened at the same time would be tried together. Regardless, Edward Sebold entered a plea of not guilty by reason of insanity to all of the charges. Edward saw 2 doctors regarding his mental state at the time of the murders. One found that there was reason to believe he was, quote, presently insane. Another doctor said he believed Eddie was insane at the time of the murders. He felt his mental illness began in the fall of 1966, after being rejected by Kathy Sinclair. At the time of Eddie's trial, the mental condition of a defendant was to be obtained by at least three specialists appointed by the judge. The doctors who had already seen and diagnosed Eddie were not appointed. Edward Siebold was three times denied the opportunity to have a hearing regarding his mental condition at the time of trial. Each time, the judge ruled that it was a matter for the jury to decide. On January 15, 1968, Edward's trial for the murder of Mary Lynn Sinclair began. The prosecution's case was that Eddie attacked the Sinclair family because Kathy broke up with him and Juanita rejected him. The prosecution said Edward Siebold was not insane, but, quote, he was a spoiled brat who recognized no authority from anyone. All psychiatrists for the prosecution said Edward Siebold was sane at the time of the killings. One psychiatrist said, quote, Edward displayed a preoccupation with sex and destruction, and his desires were all about Juanita. Edward had sadistic and destructive ideas and feelings toward women. The sadism was a dominant part of Edward's personality. Edward gains much pleasure from the thought of hurting people, women particularly. End quote. The prosecution took the spoiled brat theory and went hard for Eddie's parents on cross-examination. The prosecutor told Eddie's mother, Clara, that she and Herman, quote, never tried to control Eddie. You have given in to him and pampered him. You let him run your household instead of you running him. Clara simply answered that that wasn't true, and Herman Siebold said he did what he thought was right. The defense's case was that Eddie had been mentally unstable before he met Kathy, and that he got worse after they met. All psychiatrists for the defense said Edward was insane at the time of the killings. On January 20th, 1968, after deliberating for 3 hours, the jury found Edward guilty and recommended the death penalty. The judge sentenced Eddie to death immediately after the verdict and recommendation. Immediately following his sentencing for the murder of Mary Lynn, Edward's trial for the murder of Libba began. The judge didn't even let spectators or news people leave until the new jury had been chosen. According to the Times Tribune, Edward's trial for Libba's murder was similar to the trial for Mary Lynn. The jury was all male, the lawyers and the witnesses were the same, the testimony was the same, and so was the verdict and sentence. After the outcome of the trial for Libba's murder, Edward's trials for the murder of Maymay and the assault of Juanita were postponed until he could get more mental health testing. Neither trial was ever held. Edward Siebold appealed his sentences for both convictions on multiple grounds, but the main point in each appeal was that he was not allowed to prove insanity because his mother was not allowed to testify that she had attempted to have him institutionalized after he tried to run her over. At each trial, Clara Siebold was only able to answer 3 questions from the prosecution. But on cross-examination in Mary Lynn's case, defense attorneys were able to get quick answers from Clara, even as the prosecution objected. She blurted, "He almost ran over me with his car." On October 7, 1971, the Supreme Court of Alabama ruled against a new trial for the murder of Mary Lynn Sinclair. They agreed that the court erred by not allowing Clara Siebold to testify to the full story of trying to get her son committed, but they felt that the error was fixed on cross-examination. But on November 4, 1971, the Supreme Court of Alabama ruled that Eddie should get a new trial for the murder of Libba because the court denied his chance to prove his insanity when the jury only heard Eddie's mom answer the 3 questions. And on February 8, 1972, 2 days before Edward Siebold was to be executed for the murder of Mary Lynn, the U.S. District Court overturned his sentence, saying that he didn't get a chance to prove his insanity. After both sentences were overturned, Eddie was ordered to go back to trial for all the charges. To avoid more trials, the Sinclair family were asked if they could accept Edward Siebold pleading guilty to all counts and get life sentences instead of the death penalty. They agreed. Eddie pled guilty to the 3 murder charges and 1 charge of assault with intent to murder. He was given 3 life sentences, plus 20 years for the assault on Juanita. However, the Sinclair family did not understand that the life sentences would not be life without parole. He would get a parole board hearing every 5 years. He was first denied parole in 1977, 5 years after he pled guilty. And Eddie Siebold loves to talk to the press. In 1984, he claimed he was diagnosed with schizophrenia in an article with the Associated Press. He said, quote, "My life sort of fell apart on me." He said he felt regret and shame. And, quote, "At one point, I felt anguish, but not anymore." He also said, quote, "The worst thing they are saying about me is that I'm dangerous. I can't prove I'm not. I've been convicted of killing 3 people. I'm an excitable person and I'm irritable, but I'm not dangerous. I control myself very well." At a 2001 parole board hearing, Juanita Sinclair said, quote, "I'm neither vengeful or full of hate. I'm terrified. He has killed and killed. Now he may find some other mother's children and kill them." Kathy said directly to the parole board, quote, "You 3 people, we depend on you to protect our lives." The only person there to testify for Eddie Siebold was a worker in the prison chapel who said that Eddie was a good person who had found God and deserved mercy. Jack Durant, father of little Mary, Maymay Durant, said, quote, "Prison is the perfect place for him to spread his newfound faith. We should not forget the 2 little girls and shy teenager who died at his hands." In a 2007 interview, Eddie told the Montgomery Advertiser that he hasn't lost sleep over what he did, and he admitted he was guilty. He also said that he only had 2 targets when he went to the Sinclair house, and he intended for both targets to survive. Eddie said he thought if he attacked both targets, he'd be able to, quote, "work through the consequences." Eddie said that the spree was, quote, "a surprise attack, get in quick and get out quick." He also said his plan was to do permanent damage to the Sinclairs. Every 5 years, Eddie comes up for parole. Faye goes before the parole board every time. She tells them her story of hiding under the bed while her family was slaughtered. Kathy moved out of state, but also shows up for parole hearings, as does their mother, Juanita, and many sheriffs who worked on the case, as well as the district attorney. In 2012, after that hearing, Kathy said, quote, "Unfortunately, in 5 years, it will happen again. It's extremely stressful, but that's the law. It's hard to believe in 5 years that we will have to do this again. He ruined more lives than he could imagine. He seems to have no remorse." At the 2017 hearing, Faye said, quote, "If he ever got out, he would potentially continue on the mission he started 50 years ago. I can't fathom him ever being there. I can't fathom it." Juanita Sinclair, then 95 years old, attended the 2017 parole board hearing, just as she has every 5 years. "I cannot imagine the pain and yet the strength and endurance of this remarkable woman. To my knowledge, she is still alive. She will be 100 years old if she lives to his next parole board hearing." Eddie is currently incarcerated in Staten Correctional Center in Elmore, Alabama. It is difficult to see Edward Siebold as anything but a remorseless monster. Despite psychiatrists who did diagnose him as insane, in court, as always, it was a battle of expert witnesses. In a crime this heinous, you can see why the jury would reject insanity. Not only did Edward Siebold carefully plan and carry out the attack. He managed to escape capture for 11 days. He struck terror in the heart of everyone, not only in Auburn, but in Lee County, where the jury pool came from. And his interviews do him no favors. He is so open and says such wild things that you wonder if he does have mental issues. Because why wouldn't he just show remorse if he ever hopes to be paroled? But no, he always seems to revel in the details of the slaughter. He stalked a woman and her four daughters for over a year. In 1967, they did the best they could, getting a restraining order and having him arrested. But stalking was not yet a crime, and Eddie Siebold always walked free, no matter how much he harassed the Sinclairs. And yet, sadly, it does seem that Juanita and her neighbors understood how dangerous he was. All I can think about is 17-year-old Faye Sinclair, hiding under a bed, trying not to make a sound, as she heard her sisters and neighbor brutally murdered, trembling, trying not to cry out, and then walking around in a daze, finding their bodies in all the blood. She had the strength to answer the phone and then to check for pulses to see if anyone survived. Kathy and Juanita are also incredible survivors. Unarmed, there was nothing they could do but run for help. And all three of them show up every 5 years, painfully reliving that horrific night to make sure Edward Siebold never sees the light of day. Southern Fried True Crime is written and produced by me, Erica Kelly. The original graphic art is by Coley Horner, and Southern Fried's original music is by Rob Harrison of Gamma Radio. Southern Fried's audio is edited and mixed by Ches Gray of Gray Multimedia. Thanks so much to Haley Gray for her diligent research on this heartbreaking case. And thanks to listener Anne Free for suggesting today's episode. Remember to subscribe to the other show I narrate, Fetal Abduction, a True Crime Podcast. Our third episode was released a few days ago. Also, as a heads up, I am taking off next week for the Independence Day holiday. But don't worry, there are still 4 more weeks in July, so you'll still have 4 episodes coming up. I will be dropping 2 new promos for other new shows starting up. I just didn't want to disappoint you when you saw those in your feed and didn't get a new episode. But I do hope these new shows interest you and you'll give them a try. And I'd like to remind you to come join my Facebook group. We share memes and have a lot of laughs. It's a really fun community and we'd love to have you. Hashtag no shit asses allowed. And we've also got some new merch. If you want to check it out, go to southernfriedtruecrime.com. If you enjoyed today's show, don't forget to subscribe and please tell a friend or rate and review on iTunes. I'm also on most large platforms like Stitcher and Spotify, as well as Stitcher Premium, where you can listen ad-free. If you have any case suggestions, please email southernfriedtruecrime@gmail.com. I do not accept case suggestions on social media private messages, but please feel free to reach out by email. Not only do I get my most interesting and little-known cases from listener suggestions, I love hearing from you guys. Until next time, thanks so much for listening. Wash your hands, stop touching your face, and y'all take care.